Welcome to Oncology Today, the second issue of our program focusing on key presentations on AML and MDS from the 2020 American Society of Hematology annual meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Harry Erba from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. To begin, he presented recent phase 3 data on the use of venetoclax plus azacitidine from the VIALE-A trial in AML.
Hello, my name is Harry Erba. I'm a professor of medicine at Duke University, where I serve as the director of the leukemia program. I'm very happy today to present highlights from ASH 2020 and really focus on acute myeloid leukemia and the myelodysplastic syndromes. And I'm going to start by discussing BCL2 inhibition with venetoclax. You can see I have a full agenda here, moving on after that to IDH mutant inhibitors, FLT3 mutant inhibitors, anti-CD47 targeted therapies, specifically magrolimab. We'll talk about AML maintenance therapy that has come to life now, and then finish with some selected topics in myelodysplastic syndromes. So in November of 2018, the FDA gave accelerated approval to the combinations of the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax with hypomethylating agents and low-dose cytarabine based on phase 1b data and expansion looking quite enticing and exciting. Full approval came last summer based on the results of the VIALE-A trial that you see here, in which patients were randomly assigned 2-to-1 between venetoclax and azacitidine versus azacitidine and placebo. The study enrolled patients who were felt to be unfit for intensive chemotherapy, those 75 years of age or older, or those with significant comorbidities that are listed on this slide. The primary endpoint of the study, as you know, was overall survival, and the overall survival endpoint was reached with an improvement in median survival from 9.5 months with azacitidine placebo to 15 months with azacitidine and venetoclax. And what I love about this data is that both arms actually behaved similarly to what had been seen in prior studies with azacitidine alone or in the phase 1b study with azacitidine and venetoclax. The other thing about the shape of these Kaplan-Meier curves is that you could see with limited follow-up, the curves haven't come together yet at 24 months, and that's encouraging. So clearly, BCL2 inhibition has a role in the treatment of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. But how do these older patients fare on therapy for acute myeloid leukemia getting this combination? Keith Pratz presented this data that was from the VIALE-A trial looking at patient-reported outcomes. So I'm just going to show two slides from his presentation. One looks at the time to deterioration of quality of life scores by the ERTC quality of life questionnaire, and the next one is another quality of life score. The green line is the azacitidine, and what you can see here is that there was a trend for a longer time to deterioration of quality of life scores with azacitidine compared to azacitidine with placebo. And the same was true when we look at this quality of life score using a visual analog scale. Now, this is encouraging. However, if I'm an older patient receiving therapy for acute myeloid leukemia, I don't want to know yet how long it's going to take before I start feeling worse. I want to know how long it's going to be until I start feeling better. And this data and the way it's captured doesn't actually address that issue of improvements in quality of life. And so that data, I'm certain, is in the data sets and will need to be reported. But now that we see the activity of venetoclax with hypomethylating agents and low-dose cytarabine, of course, it begs the question, can you combine venetoclax with a number of other regimens that have been used, either both intensive or non-intensive chemotherapy? And I'm going to show you three examples of that and give some caveats about how to use this data. So this first is from MD Anderson looking at a combination of venetoclax with FLAG-IDA regimen. And they tested this combination both in the newly diagnosed patients, that's the phase 2a study, and the relapse refractory population of AML, the phase 2b. So these cohorts of patients were treated at the recommended phase 2 dosing that came from earlier reports from the phase 1b study. So my first cautionary note to people looking at this and trying to adopt it into their practice is make sure that you use the recommended phase 2 dosing, which is there on the right. And you will notice that there are a number of differences between this Idaflag regimen and Idaflag that we've been using. For example, the dose of the idarubicin is lower for both the newly diagnosed and the relapsed refractory patients, and the dose of cytarabine is reduced from 2 g/m² to 1.5 g/m². So important considerations there. The second is the venetoclax dosing. In the Aza-Ven label, you'll notice that in the first cycle, we give it for 28 days, actually 21 to 28 days, depending on response at 21 days. And then we adjust the dose based on myelosuppression afterwards. Here you can see that the venetoclax during the induction is only given for the first 14 days and during consolidation just for 7 days. When you look across all patients in the second to left column, you can see an overall response rate of 82%. Let's focus on the recommended phase 2 dosing in the newly diagnosed patients. You can see a 97% overall response rate, and 96% of these patients were MRD negative by flow cytometry. So very high response rate, very deep responses. In the green curve, you can see the newly diagnosed patients having a better event-free and overall survival than those in the relapse refractory cohorts. But my cautionary note here is to remember that Idaflag is a very myelosuppressive regimen, and we are adding venetoclax, which is myelosuppressive. So you can see here in the phase 2A and phase 2B portions of the study that there can be dose delays in count recovery. Now, these median times to count recovery are for an ANC of just over 500 and platelet count over 50,000. And you can see we're getting into the 1.5 month or 6 week time period for these delays. So be prepared for myelosuppression. So would I use this regimen? And I have. I've used it in relapsed refractory patients based on the very high response rate who I am trying to get to allogeneic stem cell transplantation, and count recovery prior to that may not be as important. Well, how about less intensive regimens? MD Anderson has developed the cladribine with low-dose cytarabine regimen previously and published on this in older patients and those unfit for intensive chemotherapy. And of course, now you can consider adding venetoclax to that regimen. In this phase 2 study, it's kind of a complicated schema where the induction is the cladribine followed by low-dose ARC, followed by a maintenance of 2 cycles with the same at reduced doses, alternating with 2 cycles of azacitidine, and each cycle with up to 21 days of venetoclax. You can see in the red square there that they treated 48 patients, that the CR rate was 77%, with 92% of these patients being MRD negative. My consideration about this trial is, how are we going to define which regimen is best to use for our patients, and what is really the endpoint that we're looking for, the outcome that we're looking for in these older patients? Does the cladribine really add anything to low-dose ARC and venetoclax, or azacitidine and venetoclax, which makes up a large part of this regimen? We can only learn this through randomized phase 3 trials that are done in a well-defined population. And then finally, I'm going to show you data in the relapsed refractory population of AML with CPX-351 in combination with venetoclax, again from MD Anderson. But I'm going to first give you an update that was presented by Jeff Lancet at this year's ASH meeting and also at the ASCO meeting. To refresh your memory, the pivotal trial leading to approval of liposomal doxorubicin cytarabine, or as we knew it, CPX-351, is shown here, and this was a study of patients who were previously untreated with high risk or secondary AML, which we now define as AML with myelodysplasia-related changes or therapy-related AML. Patients were ages 60 to 75, and they received either CPX-351 daily on days 1, 3, and 5, or 7 and 3. They could go on to receive 2 cycles of consolidation with the same, or go on to transplant. Jeff Lancet presented the update at 5 years, and you can see that there does seem to be a stable plateau on the curve. The median survivals have not changed, obviously, 6 months with 7 and 3, and just over 9 months with CPX-351. At 5 years, almost 20% of patients were still alive, having received CPX-351, and it was less than 10% with 7 and 3. Now, what's important about this data is that many of these patients could go on to an allogeneic transplant. You could see 1/3 of patients receiving CPX-351 were able to go on to transplant. meaning likely that they had achieved a response, which is often a prerequisite for a transplant, and they maintained an adequate performance in organ function. And what you can see here is the outcomes of those patients are better. And based on the number of censored marks, I would surmise that most of the patients who are long-term survivors are those who are able to undergo allogeneic transplant in remission. And so I think this is the real value of CPX351, is preparing a patient to move on to allogeneic transplant. And this benefit was seen both in younger and older patients. And it's important to note that a significant minority of the older patients, 70 to 75, actually did go on to get allo transplant. So with that as a background, it should be no surprise, based on my theme here, that we're going to try combining the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax with CPX351. All but one of the 16 patients evaluable for response had relapsed refractory disease. The dose minus one level of the venetoclax was 300 milligrams for 21 days, days 2 through 21 there. And you can see that in those 16 patients, most are evaluable for response. Look at the response rates, though. Only 6%, only one patient had a CR. The majority of responses were CRI or morphologic leukemia-free state, which indicates that the regimen does clear blasts from the marrow, but count recovery may be an issue. And in fact, to that point, the venetoclax dose had to be reduced to 300 milligrams for only 7 days due to the dose-limiting toxicity of neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. Now, this regimen of venetoclax with CPX351 is also being tested in newly diagnosed patients without AML with myelodysplasia-related changes or therapy-related AML in an umbrella study called the VFAST study. And that data will probably be presented this year at ASCO.
Yeah, I was just curious. At this point, CPX has really been targeted to these patients with secondary AML, and I kind of never really understood why. I mean, I know the data shows that, but biologically what the reason is. So it sounds like it's going to be studied in the general population as well.
It is. And so a number of points there. In the NCI and the NCTN cooperative groups, we are actually planning a study that actually has been reviewed by the Leukemia Steering Committee, looking at different induction regimens for high-risk AML patients who are younger. So not necessarily therapy-related or myelodysplasia-related changes, but poor-risk AML. And in that study, we are going to be comparing standard 7+3 as the control arm with 7+3 with venetoclax based on data coming from a phase 1b study, CPX351, and then azacitidine and venetoclax. And the primary endpoint is going to be MRD negative remissions. And then, as I mentioned, this umbrella study, if the patient has an IDH2 mutation, they receive CPX351 with enasidenib. If FLT3 mutation, CPX351 with midostaurin, and all others with venetoclax. So yes, we're going to be looking at it.
Do you think it's likely, or do you have any speculations as to whether CPX will actually work in garden variety AML as well as 7+3? Or do you think this could have been secondary to the way the trial was done? Or do you think that pharmacologically, it's maybe not going to be as effective?
Well, actually, that's a good point, Neil, because the reason why, as you alluded to, the reason why the sponsor at the time went ahead with the phase 3 study in this limited population is that this is the subset of newly diagnosed patients that showed a potential benefit over 7+3, but it wasn't worse in any subset of patients. In fact, in the entire randomized phase 2 study, there was a trend for higher remission rates and overall survival benefit in the entire group. So it doesn't appear to be worse than 7+3. And so if we take cost out of the equation here, CPX351 is an agent that might be more easily given in the outpatient setting. It's a 90-minute IV infusion, days 1, 3, and 5. And so if you have a stable patient with newly diagnosed AML, not having infections, not at risk of tumor lysis syndrome, you could actually consider using a more convenient dosing regimen of this liposomal formulation and not worry about it being worse than 7+3, just not proven to be better.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess the idea would be if these combination trials with CPX are positive, that's where the data is going to be. And I guess theoretically people would follow it then. Interesting. I was just going to say, you mentioned outpatient CPX. I'm curious, do you ever give it as an outpatient?
I do. I'm going to go back to your last comment very briefly and say one of the reasons why I actually was one of the people who helped design this trial, one of the reasons why we thought it was important to do is that clinicians are going to start patients on CPX351 in the labeled population and then get back data that the FLT3 mutation is there or that the IDH2 mutation is there and want to think about, can we add another drug without any randomized data, but at least this will give us safety data. The question about outpatient administration, in the clinical trial, almost all patients got it as an inpatient initially, but I have done the induction as an outpatient. There's actually a small series of patients published from various institutions, including Moffitt, looking at this approach. Basically, if you have a patient who does not have a very proliferative disease, is not at risk of leukostasis or tumor lysis syndrome, has good renal function, lives close to your institution, good social support, compliant, all of these recommendations, and not sick already from the AML with febrile neutropenia, you can give this as an outpatient quite safely. And in fact, in the clinical trial, 50% of patients received CPX351 as an outpatient during consolidation. And that's what I do for all of my consolidation patients because it's only on days 1 and 3, two quick 90-minute infusions that are well tolerated, at least initially as the treatment is being given.
Interesting. Please continue.
So let's move on to IDH and inhibitors of the mutant forms of IDH. Mutations occur in about 20% of patients with AML. The pathogenesis is really kind of cool. The most talked about pathogenetic mechanism by which IDH mutations may lead to AML is through a block in differentiation. IDH mutant form will convert alpha-ketoglutarate to hydroxyglutarate, which is an inhibitor of demethylase enzymes, such as TET2 and histone demethylases, leaving chromatin methylated and chromatin silenced that way. When you lower hydroxyglutarate levels with the inhibitors of the mutant forms of IDH2 with enasidenib or IDH1 with ivosidenib, it leads to a lower amount of hydroxyglutarate, which you can document, and you can actually document differentiation, leading to the number one most serious toxicity we need to consider when using these agents, and that's differentiation syndrome. In the VIALE-A trial and in the phase 1b study, as well as VIALE-C trial with low-dose Araci and venetoclax, we saw that there was apparent benefit in the IDH-mutated subset of patients with this combination. In fact, parenthetically, in the initial study of relapse refractory AML with single-agent venetoclax, Marina Konopleva and colleagues from MD Anderson published that in their cohort, the overall response rate of single-agent venetoclax in this relapse refractory population was only 18%, but 4 of the 6 remissions were in IDH-mutated patients. That's with single-agent drug. Here, showing you an analysis now of the patients who had an IDH1 or an IDH2 mutation in the phase 1b study treated with azacitidine venetoclax, and then the VIALE-A study treated with azacitidine and venetoclax. So we have a pooled analysis of 107 patients where the mutation was detected compared to 326 who did not have the mutation. And as expected from the reports of the VIALE-A and the phase 1b separately, the response rate in this cohort is very high, 72% with azavenetoclax CR-CRH, 78% CR-CRI. You could see that the median survival was much longer, a little over 2 years with azaven than the 6 months with azaplacebo, with over half of the patients still alive 24 months later. So this is quite encouraging. Now, we know that there is in the label for ivosidenib for IDH1 mutant patients is approved in the newly diagnosed population. And it begs the question, should we wait for IDH mutation analysis in these older patients or those with infirmities and decide between ivosidenib alone or in combination with azacitidine or azav with venetoclax? My take on this topic is that outside of very specific circumstances, I would use azavenetoclax based on the very high response rate, based on the larger number of patients here that were treated, based on this median survival of over 2 years. And I would save ivosidenib in the event of relapse after the azavenetoclax therapy. what situations might I consider using ivosidenib on-label or maybe enasidenib off-label in the newly diagnosed patient? Well, in a patient who does not have the ability to come in for parenteral therapy with azacitidine or decitabine and is looking for an all-oral regimen, you could consider oral ivosidenib and oral enasidenib. And of course, they're not at this year's ASH, but there's been data looking at combinations of those agents with venetoclax. Now I want to turn to specifically two abstracts that deal with ivosidenib and enasidenib. And this was an interesting one from Europe, looking at ivosidenib relative to standard therapies for relapsed refractory IDH1 mutated AML. And the genesis of this study is to gather data that might support the application of ivosidenib to the EMAA for the indication of IDH1 mutated relapsed refractory AML, adult patients who receive more than two or more prior regimens, including one standard intensive regimen, or if they're not candidates for intensive chemotherapy and have received at least one non-intensive regimen. Okay, so what they did was they matched patients with historical controls from the AML study group in Germany and real-world data from France. They looked at a number of variables to match these patients, which are listed here. But the interesting thing they did was they excluded from the historical controls those patients who received intensive chemotherapy, suggesting that the data in the phase one study actually excluded those patients. The second thing is when you look at the historical controls were from a period of time prior to using venetoclax combinations. And so I doubt very many patients in their historical controls received venetoclax combinations, but it actually wasn't described in the abstract. But with those caveats, you could see that the median overall survival with ivosidenib was longer than with historical controls, 8 months versus 3 months, and the number of CR patients higher, 18% versus 7%. So with those concerns they have about just the design of the analysis, there does seem to be a benefit. This obviously doesn't answer the question, if you have a younger patient or one that you're trying to get to transplant, is an ivosidenib-based regimen superior to or equivalent to intensive chemotherapy? We just don't know. Turning now to enasidenib, Eytan Stein presented data from the BEAT-AML study where they evaluated IDH2 mutated AML patients who were unfit for intensive chemotherapy. And in this study, patients were treated with single agent enasidenib at the labeled dose of 100 milligrams daily and could continue till progression or intolerance if they achieved a remission. If they didn't achieve a remission after 5 cycles, they can have azacitidine added in. If you look at the phase two data with enasidenib alone in those 60 patients, 47% achieved a CR or CRI. This seems a bit higher than what we would have expected in the relapse refractory patient population. And then the phase 1b with azacitidine of those 17 patients who did not respond to enasidenib alone, you can see 41% of them did, 7 of 17. And these were not brief remissions. You could see that the median overall survival, again, was 24 months in this population of older patients treated with single agent enasidenib as their initial therapy. And the median duration of response had not been reached. Now, I want to take note of this median overall survival of 24 months. It is quite impressive. And when I talk to John Bird, he says, yes, these patients really can stay on single agent enasidenib for quite a long time. But keep in mind, if patients fail and progress, we now have a number of other agents that this patient population can tolerate, such as venetoclax combinations and glastigib combinations. And so I think we're doing a better job of keeping older patients alive with acute myeloid leukemia. So the next topic is going to be FLT3 inhibitors. And I'm going to really focus just on gilteritinib for today's discussion. Gilteritinib is second generation, and so read for that, more potent, more specific, type 1 FLT3 inhibitor. Type 1 means it binds to the ATP binding site, and it will block both ITD and TKD mutations. In the phase 1 experience with single-agent gilteritinib, doses of 80 milligrams a day or higher were shown to inactivate in vivo FLT3 enzyme, and also was associated with about a 50 to 60% overall response rate. But I want to point out that most of the responses are CRIs. And for the purpose of this study, the CRI may have included patients who had neither neutrophil nor platelet count recovery. So we have to keep that in mind, the potential myelosuppression of gilteritinib. The ADMIRAL study was a global phase 3 study leading to the FDA approval of gilteritinib for a FLT3 mutated patient with relapse refractory AML based on a 2-to-1 randomization of gilteritinib versus salvage chemotherapy, both intensive or non-intensive. The top line, the CR rate was 21% with gilteritinib and 11% with salvage chemotherapy. And some might say, wow, that seems pretty low with chemotherapy. But actually, that CR rate and the CRc rate of 22%, virtually identical to what we saw in a prior study of chemotherapy alone in a trial of a prior FLT3 inhibitor, lazertinib, that was being tested. So it is what it is. But the data with gilteritinib is nothing to write home about until you add in the CRHs, which are 34%, CRc, 54%. So here's where I again come back to the comment of single agent gilteritinib. One of the troubles with it is the myelosuppression that we will see with the drug. But if you drop down to the bottom, you could see more patients were able to undergo allogeneic stem cell transplant with gilteritinib than with salvage chemotherapy. A sobering remark is down there in the very small print about the responses. The responses that you're seeing here are in the percentages in all of the patients, but they could not evaluate responses in 40% of the patients on salvage chemotherapy for a variety of reasons. The primary endpoint was met with an improvement in median survival of 5.6 months with salvage chemotherapies to 9 months with gilteritinib. You can see at 1 year, twice as many patients were alive with gilteritinib, 37% versus 17%. But look at the tails of these curves around 24 months. They come together at a very dismal 10% overall survival. And this really speaks to the fact that FLT3 mutations are a late event in leukemogenesis, never the only mutation, and will provide a proliferative signal. But if you inhibit FLT3, other mutations can still drive this leukemic process. Okay, so with that as a background, let's look at some of the things that were presented at ASH this year. One of the topics that comes up frequently is now that we use midostaurin in combination with intensive chemotherapy for younger patients with FLT3 mutated AML based on the results of the RATIFY trial that was led by my friend in Boston, Rich Stone. How do patients who've received midostaurin or even sorafenib, another first generation type 1 inhibitor, fare once they receive gilteritinib? And I'll just drop down to the bottom of that table, both in the phase 1 study of gilteritinib chrysalis or in the ADMIRAL trial, you could see that the response rates, whether the patient had a prior TKA or not, were not affected, being about 40% in the chrysalis study and about 50% in the ADMIRAL trial. And the patients who received gilteritinib with a prior TKI in blue did better than the patients who received salvage chemotherapy with a prior TKI in green. That was not statistically significant. What happens after you treat a patient with a FLT3 inhibitor as part of their initial therapy? This is an MD Anderson experience looking at a cohort of 67 patients who received initial therapy with a FLT3 inhibitor with either low intensity or high intensity chemotherapy. And that's all listed for you on the left. We're only going to be looking now in this analysis at the patients who achieved a remission with a FLT3 inhibitor. And what I'm showing you on this slide are the emergent mutations that are seen in patients who received a type 2 FLT3 inhibitor, which I haven't defined for you previously. A type 2 FLT3 inhibitor is one that binds to FLT3 and maintains the inactive conformation of the enzyme. However, when you have a tyrosine kinase domain mutation, the enzyme folds into the active conformation immediately. And so type 2 inhibitors do not have activity against TKD mutations, only ITD mutations. Quizartinib is an example of an investigational drug here in the States, approved in Japan for FLT3 mutated patients with an ITD mutation. Well, in that subset of patients, you can see if you get a type 2 inhibitor, 30% of the time at the time a patient relapses, if they have a mutation, it's in the tyrosine kinase domain, the aspartate at 835. But also keep in mind, down in blue at the bottom of the slide, patients who were initially treated with FLT3 inhibitors, when they relapse, about a quarter of them no longer actually had a FLT3 mutation, again, indicating that this is not the primary driver of AML. This is a late event in leukemogenesis that may not be present at the time of relapse. It makes the point you really need to do mutational analysis both at diagnosis and at relapse. Okay, with that being said about the type 2 FLT3 inhibitors, then clearly gilteritinib being a type 1 inhibitor should be the answer. But of course, leukemia is smarter than we are. And if you start whacking at the FLT3 with a type 1 inhibitor, that's true. You may not get a TKD mutation popping up, but you do get mutations that are off target. And the most common would be in the RAS-MAP kinase. And so it makes the point that single agents are very unlikely to be effective at being the answer for AML in all patients. And we really need to think about sequential or combination studies, which I'll conclude with at the end. Okay, now let's get to combinations. We talked about combination of BCL2 inhibitors with chemotherapy. How about gilteritinib with intensive or non-intensive chemotherapy? So I'm showing you this slide only to give people pause at home if they're thinking of adding gilteritinib to intensive chemotherapy instead of midostaurin. It has not been proven yet that a second generation, more potent and specific FLT3 inhibitor actually would be preferable to midostaurin, a first generation, less specific agent. And those studies actually are ongoing. But of course, to inform those studies, we need to get some idea about the safety of combining gilteritinib with chemotherapy. So what I'm showing you about this complicated phase 1b study is various doses of gilteritinib were used. Daunorubicin was used, idarubicin was used, various doses of Ara-C. And at the end of the day, you could put all of the data together, and I'm just going to focus on the total FLT3 mutated, the 38 patients in the study, because not all of them were FLT3 mutated. Okay, so if you notice, we had 38 patients. The response rate was impressive, 82%. But I would argue, if you give younger patients with a FLT3 mutation 7 and 3, followed by high-dose cytarabine, is 80% really that different from what we might have seen historically? What concerns me is here, that overall response rate was evenly divided between a true CR and a CRI, which again, in the small print in that footnote, indicates that neither the platelets nor the ANC may have recovered, which may be quite important for patients having neutropenic infections or hemorrhagic problems after induction therapy, and also important in thinking about when to go on to your consolidation. Okay, how about combining gilteritinib with less intensive chemotherapy? And I'm showing you this data from my colleague up at Roswell Park, Eunice Wang, who runs the leukemia program there. This is a 3-arm study that had a safety run-in, safety cohort of gilteritinib with azacitidine. And the idea of the Lacewing study was then to compare gilteritinib as a single agent to the combination of gilteritinib with azacitidine to azacitidine alone. I will tell you now that arm A was closed by the sponsor, and it wasn't quite clear from the discussion at ASH why that decision was made. Interestingly, and this got a number of questions at ASH, the trial is ongoing comparing arm AC to arm C. And the criticism has been, is it legitimate, is it ethical even, to treat an older patient unfit for chemotherapy with single agent azacitidine based on the results of the VIALE-A trial? And Dr. Wang addressed that question by saying, if you look at the hazard ratio for overall survival in the VIALE-A trial in the FLT3 mutated subset, there was a slight trend for a better survival with AzaVen, but it did not meet statistical significance. So this study is ongoing, but at ASH, really all she could present is what I'm showing you here, the safety cohort of 15 patients treated with the combination of Aza with gilteritinib at 120 milligrams a day. And I will just suffice it to say, in this very small subset or group of patients, the overall response rate was 67%, evenly divided between a true CR and again, this CRC. Among the 10 patients who achieved the CRC, though, the median duration of remission was 10 months. And now getting to what I alluded to earlier, combinations of these targeted therapies with venetoclax. I'm not presenting today any data with IDH inhibitors with venetoclax. That data has been presented at other symposia. But I am going to spend a little bit of time on this all-oral therapy of gilteritinib with venetoclax in FLT3 or wild type in the initial dose escalation AML that was relapsed or refractory. And I really want to focus on the dose expansion, which was venetoclax 400 milligrams a day with gilteritinib 120 milligrams a day, those 46 patients. So both drugs being used at their recommended dosing. And here's the response rate. If you just look at all patients, it's similar to prior FLT3 exposure. In all 41 patients that they had response data on, you can see the MCRC rate is 85.4%. It used to be so easy to understand CR. I mean, just two letters, complete remission. I knew what that was. Now we have things like MCRC. What does that stand for? Well, look what it includes. If you look at those colors, it includes CR, which was 7% of patients. It includes CRI, which was 7%, and CRP, 20%. But the majority of that 85% were morphologic leukemia-free states, which means the marrow was ablated of blasts, not ablated, still had some hematopoiesis, but less than 5% blasts, but none of the counts recovered. Now, it's great that this combination had an 85% response rate by CRC, and that was higher than what was seen in the ADMIRAL trial that I just showed you of 52%. But still, I think we have to be concerned about using this as a standard of care for an older patient with AML. Count recovery is going to be very important to their quality of life. And they presented in the small cohort their survival data. They also presented data showing deep levels of remission, which I won't stress, other to say that using less intensive therapies, we really don't have good data that an MRD negative response translates into some kind of survival benefit. The biggest concern I have about using this regimen is, as I've alluded to before, gilteritinib and venetoclax are both myelosuppressive. Now, the early and 60-day mortality were quite low, but five patients achieving a marrow CRC died, likely, is my guess, due to the complications of pancytopenia. Let's move on to something exciting, not only in myeloid malignancies, but quite frankly, likely to be an exciting topic in all of oncology, and that's this targeting CD47. And I'm going to focus on data with magrolimab. Magrolimab is a first-in-class macrophage immune checkpoint inhibitor targeting CD47. CD47 is found on all cells, and it binds to SIRP alpha on macrophage and provides a don't eat me signal, tells the macrophage not to engulf that cell. The antibody will bind to CD47 and it'll do two things. Number one, it blocks the interaction, but it also provides an eat me signal because the Fc portion of the molecule is active and will bind to Fc receptors on the macrophage, leading to phagocytosis. So on the top there, the panel that's moving, there's no antibody there. It's a control antibody, and the red macrophage are not able to engulf the green tumor cells. But now if you look below, in the presence of the anti-CD47 monoclonal antibody, the macrophage are engulfing the leukemic cells. Pretty cool. I think these videos are shown at every single presentation of data on anti-CD47. Now I'm going to show you the subset data in AML from this magrolimab study in combination with azacitidine. First of all, let me focus on the patient population. The patient population, 64 patients in bold there, I want to focus on 3/4 were P53 mutated. And the median baseline variant allelic frequency was quite high, 73.3%. And the reason for this skewing towards this less common population, the P53 mutated AML, which is typically only 5 to 10% of an AML population, is that the investigators started seeing activity in this subset of patients and preferentially enrolling their patients with P53 mutations on the study. Now, one caveat about using this anti-CD47 monoclonal antibody, which may be prevented with second generation 47 targeting agents, is that you get on target anemia because CD47 is present on the red cells, leading to an initial drop in the hemoglobin. This anemia, due to the on-target effect, can be ameliorated by giving a lower dose of the drug at first with a maintenance dosing regimen. The overall response rate in all of AML of the 43 patients was 63%, two-thirds of those being CRs, and 69% overall response rate in P53 mutated AML with a 45% response rate. Now, if you add up the CR and CRI rate for the P53 mutated, you get 59%. If you actually go to the VIALE-A trial where they've looked at the subset of patients with P53 mutation, the CR/CRI rate was 55%. So it's not remarkably different than what I would have expected with AZA and venetoclax. You saw deep remissions in terms of cytogenic remissions, MRD negativity, but what was really impressive was the median duration of response seemed longer than what was being seen with azacitidine. Again, not a randomized trial, but it begs the question in this subset of patients, azacitidine, AZA anti-CD47 antibody for P53 mutated, or better yet, potentially combinations of all of them. Because when you look at the overall survival of the 47 patients who received AZA magrolimab in this study, the median survival was 13 months, which is longer than what was seen in the azacitidine study. So it is encouraging. Now for something completely new and different in the therapeutic landscape of AML, and that's oral azacitidine, or CC486. CC486, or oral azacitidine, was approved by the U.S. FDA on September 1st, 2020, based on the results of the QUASAR study presented by Andrew Wei at ASH 2019. So he has given me some of his slides that looked at the design of this study. This was a study of patients who were 55 years of age and older, received intensive induction chemotherapy and consolidation chemotherapy in 80% of those CR patients, maintained a CR, did not undergo a stem cell transplant, and then were randomized one-to-one between CC486, 300 milligrams daily for 14 days in a 28-day cycle, or placebo. The patients had response assessments every 3 months by marrow, and if the marrow percentage went up by 5 to 15%, they were allowed to go up to an optional increased dosing schedule of 21 days of either CC486 or placebo. I don't have slides on this analysis, but this data was presented by Hartmut Döhner at ASH 2020, showing that about 25% of patients who received the longer duration dose of CC486 who had had this early relapse were able to regain a response. Interestingly, however, and pointing out some of the vagaries of estimating blast percentages on marrows, some of the placebo patients also seem to respond, quote unquote, with a decrease in the blast percentage. Let's move on to the primary endpoint of this study, though, which was overall survival. The median overall survival was improved from 15 months with placebo to 25 months with oral azacitidine, clearly statistically significant. But if you look at the shape of these curves, you see, again, out around 4 to 5 years, these curves are coming together at about 20%. I really believe that most of the benefit of oral azacitidine is in the delay of relapse, not the prevention of relapse of these patients. And you can see the relapse-free survival bears that out. Gail Robos presented data looking at an assessment of measurable residual disease by flow cytometry, which was embedded in the protocol. They had screening samples at baseline, and then you could see every 3 cycles after that. They used flow cytometry with a cutoff of greater than 0.1% leukemic blast by flow cytometry based on ELN recommendations. And what they showed is that roughly half of the patients were MRD positive at baseline and half were MRD negative. If you look on the right, the patient population that was MRD positive at baseline, they had benefit in terms of survival with a hazard ratio of just under 0.7 that was statistically significant. On the other hand, the MRD negative group had a trend for a better survival, but it did not meet statistical significance. when you take all this data together, what does it suggest? It suggests that patients who are in a very deep remission and possibly even cured of their disease already with initial induction and consolidation may not truly benefit from oral azacitidine, which is really going to be delaying relapse. And so in the QUASAR study, older patients who didn't undergo transplant were registered. I think when we think about the label that includes younger patients, we should really not see this as a substitute for allogeneic transplant in a younger, fit patient who is looking for curative options. The final point I'll make here is that I mentioned 80% of patients underwent consolidation in this trial. So 20% did not. If you look at the hazard ratio for survival in patients who received 0, 1, or 2 or more cycles of consolidation, the hazard ratio for survival increased across those cohorts. Again, this is a secondary analysis, very small patient numbers, but it's again suggesting the patients who were able to complete 2 to 3 cycles of consolidation, which is my standard of care for my older patients, may not have the same benefit as patients who are not able to undergo consolidation or is only attenuated. I like this part of the data just to make a point about MRD assessments. We should all be impressed that 40% or 37% patients MRD positive at baseline became MRD responders with oral azacitidine, except when you compare it to the placebo group, where 20% became MRD responders with placebo, showing you again some of the vagaries of making these MRD assessments based on a number of potential procedural and artifactual problems with estimates of measurable residual disease. And finally, myelodysplastic syndrome. And I'm going to present which, in my opinion, if there was room, should have been a plenary session presentation at ASH. I was not an author on this trial, but I think it's very important in our day-to-day management of these patients. A few years ago, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid basically threatened not to support reduced intensity allogeneic transplants for Medicare recipients with high-risk MDS because the only data we had showing a benefit of transplant was retrospective cohort comparisons, no randomized data. To the credit of the NIH, the NLHBI, and the BMT-CTN, they proposed to do a randomized trial trying to prove the benefit of allogeneic transplant. And during this time, CMS agreed to a moratorium where they would continue to fund transplants until the data came out. The data was presented as an oral presentation by Corey Cutler and first author Nakamura. This was an open-label multicenter biologic assignment study. So what I mean by this is that patients with high-risk MDS, intermediate 2 and high-risk MDS by international prognostic score, were assigned to be in a donor group if they had an 8 out of 8 HLA match related or unrelated donor. They did not include mismatched donors, umbilical cord donors, haploidentical donors, and of course we know the donor pool has expanded greatly, and I'll come back to that point in a second. They enrolled patients 50 to 75 with MDS, and they had to be candidates for traditional reduced intensity transplant, which means they were seen at a transplant center and deemed appropriate for transplant. So that's important. They had an early referral for transplant. The arms were well balanced. Here's the result. The primary endpoint of the study was reached. If you look based on an intent to treat analysis, based on a donor, no donor assignment in this age group, the donor arm had a 21% improvement in overall survival and 15% improvement in leukemia-free survival over the no-donor arm. And specifically, to address the concerns of CMS, if you look at the subset of patients over the age of 65, 66 and older, the hazard ratio statistically favored the donor group. Now, one of the troubles with these donor-no-donor analyses is non-compliance with the assignment. And you can see this study was no exception. This is very commonly seen, especially in the United States, where there's a donor, no donor assignment, but about 25% of patients will not be compliant with the assignment. Why? Well, because they were allocated to the no donor group, but their doctor said, look, we're getting great results with haploidentical transplants, the cord blood transplants, and they got a transplant, even though they were in the no donor group. Or they were in the reduced intensity transplant group and they got a myeloablative transplant. So this analysis, they just looked at, okay, let's separate the patients by whether or not they got any transplant. And here you can see there was a 30% difference in overall survival with more than 40% of patients still alive at 3 years and leukemia-free survival being improved.
Those overall numbers, I mean, are incredible.
Yeah. So the point of this is that this is patients up to the age of 75. And so we shouldn't be ageist and we should leave it to the transplant centers to really decide, is this a transplant eligible patient? And the patient will have to jump through a lot of hoops. They may need to get a cardiac assessment, pulmonary assessments. They have to have means to get the transplant, financial, but also caregiver means and socio-psychologic support. So there's a lot that goes into being a transplant candidate, but that should be left to the transplant centers to make that assessment. They're best set up to do that. Quick note about luspatercept. Luspatercept is a first-in-class anti-TGF-beta trap molecule that's given by subcutaneous injection every 3 weeks. And it's been shown in the Medalist trial to have about a 30% response rate in terms of erythroid response, transfusion independence in patients who have MDS with ring sideroblasts. These patients often have an SF3B1 mutation, but that's not in the label. So ring sideroblasts who were resistant to erythropoietic stimulating agents. And in this trial, they looked at patient-reported outcomes in terms of quality of life. And I find this analysis interesting because in the assessment of toxicities and what we've seen in our own practice here at Duke, one of the major toxicities that our patients receiving luspatercept may complain of is shortness of breath and fatigue, even though they're having an erythroid response. Having said that, though, when you look at this quality of life assessment, there doesn't seem to be any decrement from the baseline quality of life. However, I would turn this around and say, wait a second, we're giving patients either placebo in best supportive care or luspatercept in best supportive care. Wouldn't you expect quality of life to get better? Wouldn't you want it to get better in those patients who are having an erythroid response? And this does not show that. So that's a concern of mine about this quality of life assessment. They did go on to look at patient-reported outcomes in terms of how they felt about being dependent on transfusions. And this complicated data just meant to say that more patients in luspatercept arm felt better about not being as dependent on transfusions. But in my opinion, I think luspatercept clearly has a role in the treatment of anemia with MDS, low and intermediate one risk with ring sideroblasts. But the mechanism of this fatigue and dyspnea really needs to be worked out because I think that can impair any improvement in quality of life that we might see.
So you're saying that you see dyspnea and fatigue as like an on-target effect? It's not about anemia or anything?
It's separate from the anemia. That's exactly right. It was higher in that group than in the placebo group. And the mechanism of that is not understood with this anti-TGF-beta trap protein. It's interesting if you look at the toxicity tables with another drug that targets cytokines, and that's ruxolitinib, there is a signal in the toxicity tables for grade 3 dyspnea more so than placebo in the COMFORT 1 trial. So I don't think it's well understood, but something we really need to be cognizant of.
That's really interesting. I assume that cardiac status was looked at?
Yes. Haven't seen any change there.
Any speculations about what it is?
I can't explain it.
For some reason, when you said dyspnea, I kind of flashed on carfilzomib, the proteasome inhibitor they use in myeloma. Initially, when they started using it, maybe you use it, but they saw this dyspnea and nobody really knew what was going on. Then they thought it was fluid. Now they think it's maybe cardiorespiratory. It took a long time to figure out, but I never heard that about luspatercept. That's really interesting. Does it seem to be related to the treatment? Is it more shortly after you get it?
It's when you're on therapy, and if you stop the therapy, it gets better.
Wow. But it's continuous.
Yes. And not in all patients, obviously, but it is something to be concerned with. Okay, a couple of other things very quickly. Lenalidomide. Really? A phase 3 study of lenalidomide? Is this really needed in low-risk deletion 5q MDS patients? Well, actually, I really like this study because it addresses a question that I get all the time. How about if you have a patient with deletion 5q, low-risk MDS, but they're not transfusion dependent yet? Is there any benefit of giving them lenalidomide early? And I have this discussion with my patients all the time, and I'll come back to how my patients often vote on this. But what I'm showing you here is patients who were not transfusion dependent. They received lenalidomide at a lower dose, right? At only 5 milligrams daily, not 10 milligrams daily, versus placebo. If you look at response, all of these things I'm showing you in the lenalidomide group on the far right are higher than what we're seeing with placebo. 72% had an erythroid response. The median hemoglobin increased 2.8 grams per cent. And complete cytogenetic remission rate, 70%. That was higher than what was reported in the initial studies of lenalidomide in deletion 5q MDS patients. And the time to transfusion dependency was longer in patients randomly assigned to lenalidomide than placebo. However, with this short follow-up, there's no difference in overall survival, and there's no difference in the risk of progression to AML. So what do I do with this data? The intriguing feature about the use of lenalidomide in deletion 5q MDS is that you can get cytogenetic remissions. And based on our experience in CML and AML and other leukemias, we want to believe that's going to translate into a survival benefit. But we don't know that yet. And we have to consider the toxicities, if for no other reason, the cost, but also the toxicities of lenalidomide the earlier you start it. And so I do have this conversation with my patients, and I could tell you most patients not only elect to hold on taking lenalidomide for what will be the rest of their life as long as it's working, but often if their erythropoietin levels are low, will opt to receive erythropoietic stimulating agent as opposed to lenalidomide before moving on to lenalidomide. Now, of course, I don't know if my practice there is doing the patient a disservice in delaying the lenalidomide, but I do think these are all options for typically older patients who basically are suffering from the toxicities or the adverse events associated with anemia and may not be looking for other adverse events to complicate their lives, such as cytopenias or thromboembolic disease. Two other studies before I wrap this up. This was an important one. We've seen some of this data last year at ASH 2019, and we now have the phase 2 expansion cohorts of a phase 1b/2 study of azacitidine with venetoclax for higher risk MDS. And so this was presented by Jackie Garcia from Boston, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where they included patients with no prior MDS therapy who had intermediate to or higher risk myelodysplastic syndrome and less than 20% blasts at baseline. And they received azacitidine at the standard dosing that's listed there on the slide, and then venetoclax for 14 days. And that's important. That came from the dose escalation, not for 21 to 28 days, for only 14 days. And with that, you could see 83% of patients had some form of neutropenia, half of the patients febrile neutropenia with this combination, leading most of these patients to have serious adverse events since we admit patients typically with febrile neutropenia. Half of the patients had worsening thrombocytopenia as well. And so this suggests, again, there's no control arm here, but it suggests a little bit higher rate of febrile neutropenia than we're expected to see if we're just giving single agent azacitidine alone. But the 30-day mortality after the first dose was only 1%. The overall response rate was quite impressive. Again, 80% overall response rate. But again, with this combination, I want to point out that the CR rate was 40%. And the overall response rate, which included this marrow CR, which means the marrow had less than 5% blast, but the counts didn't recover, was equivalent, around 40%. Now, quite frankly, though, a CR rate of 40% with azavenetoclax is quite impressive compared to typical 15 to 20% CR rates with single agent azacitidine. So I do think that compares well. And the median duration response after CR was over a year, 14 months. And the median time to CR was a little bit quicker than we see with azo alone. So the median time to CR, 2.6 months. So this is impressive data, but remember, about half of the responses are going to be marrow CRs where the counts don't recover. But keep in mind that this might be an excellent therapy to move a patient to allogeneic stem cell transplant. In fact, 21% of the patients did so.
Is this a strategy that if you could get it paid for, you would utilize, or are you utilizing it in your practice?
I am, but I'll tell you where I'm utilizing it more. I'm not convinced yet that the added myelosuppression is necessary in all patients. But if I have a patient who's a transplant candidate, I would go with this regimen. And the reason for that is 80% of patients will basically clear the bone marrow blast. And that's often a requirement by our transplant colleagues who are using reduced intensity preparative regimens, which seem to have less activity, higher relapse rates in patients who have still detectable blasts in their blood or their bone marrow. And so I do think it's a great preparative regimen to prepare a patient for allogeneic transplant. If not, you can consider adding venetoclax on later. However, again, there's no data to support doing that. And here's overall survival. Again, it's in a limited patient population, but the median overall survival, a very respectable 27 months. Finally, just a comment about the NED8 activating enzyme inhibitor, pevonedistat. NED8 activating enzyme is high up in the proteasome pathway, important in ubiquitinization of proteins and targeting them for proteasome degradation. NED8 activating enzyme inhibitor pevonedistat was shown in a phase 1 study in which I participated to have single agent activity, and in a dose of 20 milligrams per meter squared on days 1, 3, and 5 with azacitidine has been shown to be tolerable. There was a randomized phase 2 study of azacitidine alone versus azacitidine with pevonedistat. And the bottom line, that was presented at ASCO, and it was, in my mind, a negative study. But Mikhail Sekeris took a look at the data, and what he did, and it's not on this slide, but he went back and he looked at the patient population. And instead of just using the International Prognostic Scoring System for risk stratification, he used a Cleveland Clinic model when he was there before he moved to risk stratify patients. So that's been published by their group in leukemia. And so he identified these higher risk MDS patients and then looked at that subset. And in that subset, there was a higher overall response rate with pevonedistat with azacitidine. There was a higher CR rate, which was quite impressive, 50% with the combination. And what they showed here was, in this selected group of patients, an event-free survival benefit with a p-value of less than 0.05 and a trend for improvement in survival. Randomized phase 3 studies of pevonedistat are ongoing, including in combination with hypomethylating agents and venetoclax. And so the true value of targeting this NED8 activating enzyme needs to really be fleshed out from those phase 3 studies. So just a few maybe high-level comments at the end of all this. Boy, it's a lot of data. It is. It's a huge amount of data. And the question is, what are we going to do with this? Well, I mean, we have this data because we understand the biology of AML better, and this has led to the development of targeted agents, first enzyme inhibitors like FLT3 inhibitors, IDH mutant inhibitors, ABL inhibitors to go way back. And then inhibitors of protein-protein interactions, and I think venetoclax is a prime example of that, inhibiting BCL2 interactions and acting to re-engage apoptosis. And now engaging the innate immune system with activators of the innate immune system with anti-CD47 approaches. I haven't had time to cover other immune modulators like TIM3 found on leukemic stem cells. But given the mutational heterogeneity of AML, and as I mentioned with IDH inhibitors, with FLT3 inhibitors, it's very unlikely that a single targeted therapy will significantly improve the outcomes of patients. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to do a few things. One is we know chemotherapy works, and so we're going to start combining targeted agents with chemotherapy. And I showed you a bunch of this data. But we have to be prepared for the toxicities that I mentioned. And we also have to really clearly assess what is going to be the goal of therapy. As I answered for the MDS population, if I'm trying to get a patient to a transplant, I'd be satisfied with ablating the marrow or clearing the marrow of MDS and getting a marrow CR without count recovery. If I'm talking about an 80-year-old with MDS, she needs count recovery. Otherwise, she'll be getting neutropenic infections or thrombocytopenic complications. What are we going to do with the targeted therapies? Are we going to be like the myeloma doctors and just keep adding them together with concomitant use? Or does it make more sense to give sequential use? As we combine these therapies, again, we have to think about how we're going to manage the overlapping toxicities. And then again, we have to consider what is really the goal of combining these therapies. Is it just getting a deeper response that may or may not translate into an improvement in overall survival? We really need the data to see if these deeper responses will be translatable. But what is really clear is that the available therapeutic options are rapidly increasing, which means every day we're left with many new questions in our daily practice. But I think what helps me the most in sorting out how to use this data is always considering for the patient in front of me, what is the goal of treatment for that patient? And then that helps me choose not only the initial therapy, but the journey that the patient may set out on.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Erba, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.